Mayor Curry brings an end to talk of selling JEA. Shad Khan says he's going to buy the Jaguars' London home, Wembley Stadium. And drama on the Duval County School Board. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you're ready for a great spring weekend out there. Keep listening because we are always live on the radio at 9. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, my gosh, what a news week. We're going to discuss it all for most of the hour today with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now and join us at 549-2937. Then later, don't miss the live and studio performance from the Civic Orchestra of Jacksonville. It's a preview of their free concert this weekend at the Ritz Theater. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday. Do you have that Friday feeling? I know I do. Time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Tessa Duval of the Florida Times Union. Hey, Tessa.
Good morning.
WJCT contributor and our own board member, Charles Griggs, is here.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, he's editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Hey, Tim. And David Cotton of the Financial News and Daily Record.
Good morning.
So good to have all four of you here because there is so much to talk about this week. Two huge stories, actually more than two. Everything from Shad Khan's bombshell announcement Thursday that he's going to buy Wembley Stadium in London, perhaps the most iconic sports arena in the world. There's been drama on the Duval County School Board, too. We'll talk about that. All of that ahead. But our top story right now this morning, Lenny Curry comes out officially against the idea of selling JEA. In an emailed statement to WJCT News, the mayor says unequivocally that he will not submit any JEA privatization plan to the city council. Now, Curry had been accused from many quarters of pushing for a sale behind the scenes while publicly remaining neutral on the controversial idea, but that is something he continues to deny. Just last week on this very program, two callers to the show told us that they were paid $100 apiece to take part in a focus group run by a group tied to Mayor Curry. In the focus group, they were asked how they felt about the issue of privatizing the city-owned utility, JEA. Here's caller Dwayne Sweet from last Friday.
They called me and asked me would I be a part of it. And when I went into it, I didn't know what it was going to be about. But once I got there, I found out that, you know, it was about the selling the JEA and how the community felt about it. They said they were doing this throughout the city.
All right. And as all of that swirls around City Hall, of course, there's been more controversy after the former CEO of the utility resigned earlier this month. An interim CEO was appointed to the board amidst more controversy. He was a board member, Aaron Zahn. He has no major utility experience. So much to discuss here. Get on the line now with your thoughts and comments at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we want your comments as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. David Cotton of the Daily Record, let's begin with you. Mayor Curry was facing pretty fierce headwinds on this thing. JEA's unions were coming out swinging against selling the utility. Prominent members of the community, like Jaguars owner Shad Khan, we'll get to him in a minute. Former Jacksonville Mayor Jake Godbold publicly saying this is a terrible idea. Here on this program, we reported that the Gainesville firm Data Targeting that worked to elect the mayor conducted a focus group study on this in February. This has been such a point of talk and controversy around town for weeks. Your thoughts now on the mayor saying officially this idea is dead?
Well, it's good to actually hear an opinion from the mayor. I mean, since November, his entire, you know, shtick with this has been, oh, you know, I need more information. I can't make a decision. So I think it's them reading the tea leaves and saying, for right now, this is not something we want to push. I'm not saying that it officially came from the mayor's office, but those are kind of the rumors floating around, is that, you know, this has been pushed from his side. And now they're saying, well, maybe we should just back off maybe after council elections start.
Yeah, in this day and age, perception is reality. And the perception was that outgoing board member Tom Petway kind of started the ball rolling in this direction. And I think the mistrust came in when the letter went out to the employees of JEA. And you know, people were wondering, where did that come from and what was that all about? And then that kind of started.
And the letter meaning, let's explain what the letter was.
Yeah, it was asking the members, I guess the employees, to kind of stick around if a sale took place, would take place. And so, you know, the mayor sort of, denied it have anything to do with that.
JEA.
Sure. And then, of course, the city council had a special committee investigating this, Tim and Tessa. They were going to subpoena people. They did subpoena one person, the former CEO. They were going to put people under oath, creating this idea that perhaps people weren't being transparent about this.
I think that's the rub here, isn't the idea of examining if JEA should be sold. You know, Network for Business Publication, the idea of examining if JEA should be sold is not a bad one. It's a business, and businesses do analysis like that. The feeling was that there was a behind-the-scenes rush to sell it, that without transparency, without oversight, that this was all being done quickly and behind the scenes, and that freaks people out. Even if it was a wonderful idea, the haste with which it appeared to be being done would freak people out. So I think that's a big part of it, that it immediately turned from let's examine if it's a good idea to let's have a political circus around this question because it's being forced through.
It was a political circus. Tessa Duval.
I think that haste is what was really putting people off. They didn't have the time to really form opinions about it because it just seemed it went straight from being suggested to a political firestorm. And it's really hard to navigate that if you're just trying to get it from news coverage. If you just want the facts, the political circus is kind of getting in the way of a thing like that. And so I think that what we've seen is that this was a wildly unpopular thing, at least in the way that it was being done, the way it was being talked about. And that's probably why we're seeing it slow down now.
And it's 549-2937. Give us a call here on the Friday Roundtable. Let us know your thoughts as the mayor officially now says JEA privatization is a dead letter. David Cotton, of course, as you pointed out, for all throughout this process, the mayor has steadfastly denied he had anything to do with this idea being floated. That said, has the mayor lost political capital in the wake of this controversy?
I don't know if he's lost political capital. I think he's just saying that, in another month or so, we're going to have a much more friendly council president installed in Aaron Bowman. And Aaron Bowman has said, he told me yesterday, this is a waste of time. This entire exercise of this committee that Anna Brochet formed has been, a waste of time and resources, both on council and with JEA, and that we should just get back to work. And so I think it's just the mayor's political team saying, okay, let's just cool it down a little bit. And then when Aaron's installed and when Aaron Zahn gets a couple of months under his belt and they introduce this bold strategy that they said they wanted to introduce yesterday in front of the city council committee, then, maybe this will pick back up.
So over the mayor's tenure, he's been pretty good about getting what he wants through smart strategy and planning. And this is one of those hiccups, politicians consider, they look at success and wins and losses. They chalk them up. And this is one of those things that you kind of have to step back and see, where did we go wrong? The optics were bad. Let's start with a clean slate and figure out how maybe perhaps if we're going to evaluate or start an evaluation process, how do we do that and involve in the public and make it feel more transparent?
Or at least make the public feel like they're involved. Yeah, I think the two key points that you just kind of made there is, one is the mayor has been successful in the past in kind of a hand wavy sort of way. Pension reform famously passed, and I still to this day don't know if anybody can really explain exactly what happened there. But the mayor, through force of personality or just the way he was able to bring the electorate along, was able to get that done. I do wonder if there was a sense that, hey, it worked that time, let's try it now and get this big thing done without giving a lot of information. But it's also clear that the mayor did not say in his letter that he's never going to return to this. It was just, now's not the time sort of thing. So it would surprise no one, I think, if this does come up again, and perhaps very quickly.
And if it comes up again, Tessa Duval, has the well been poisoned for this in terms of the really strong public sentiment against this idea. I think perhaps maybe some of the political team David Cotton referenced, maybe they underestimated how strongly people in the city feel about keeping this utility a city-owned asset.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think something else that we have to consider is the new CEO. How will JEA perform under this new CEO who my colleagues, Nate Monroe, Chris Hong, and Mark Woods have found some information from his background and past business efforts that didn't pan out very well for him. So we have someone who's not only unproven at a utility, but someone who's also proven to have some struggles in other parts of Florida. We have hurricane season coming up. We have a lot of challenges that JEA will face in the interim between now and whatever decision that might come up about selling it. So I think that whatever happens with the organization could also have a big effect on how people look at selling it.
Yeah.
I think that's part, though, of the idea of putting Melissa Dykes as COO president. You know, she was... she's been CFO. She's highly regarded both by employees and by the industry in general. You know, she made a good pitch to be interim CEO in part because of her experience in dealing with hurricanes. And I think that to a certain extent, she's going to have that unenviable task of not having the title of CEO, but president and CEO. She's going to be running it while Aaron is, you know, talking to
Wait, you mean a company's going to be run by a woman privately while the male...
I have never heard of such a thing. That's unprecedented, Tim. I know. You and Tessa in particular couldn't even imagine that.
I can't think of any organizations like that. Oh, wait, I can think of a lot.
You know, and Zahn yesterday, you know, that's we're partners in this, you know, we're going to be, you know, hand in hand. But it's very obvious that, you know, Melissa Dykes is going to be the day-to-day operator of this utility, whereas Zahn's going to be out there. He's going to be answering questions with the media. He's going to be up there taking the glory, I guess you could say.
And the bigger salary.
And the bigger salary. Now, Melissa Dykes is going to get a contract. I'm not going to throw out her salary here in public, but it's definitely not what Paul McElroy was making. Significantly lower. So we'll see if in that negotiation she's able to, you know, make some ground on that front. Okay. Maybe she doesn't
and
care
Zahn
about that.
Zahn was clear in saying that his role is going to be, his strengths are in the political aspect.
Buzzwords.
Yeah.
Let's go to some calls now. It's our Friday roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. In a moment, we are going to talk about Shah Khan and Wembley Stadium. But first, what are your thoughts about Mayor Curry calling an end to talks to privatize JEA? 549-2937. Christopher is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Christopher. Good morning.
Good morning. About a week, I have a little fact. I've been following the JEA thing very closely in media, and I've not heard this from any place, except that about a week ago I was talking to a council person. I won't name him publicly, but I would, you know, privately. And he said, I just said, you know, for my money, I don't want you to sell JEA. He said, I don't think it's going to happen. He said, I got a hold of the contract that the JEA signed with, I think it's Vogtle, whatever the atomic power plant is. He says it's over 300 pages long. And in that contract, there was an agreement that the full faith and pledge of the city of Jacksonville was in this agreement. He says, I don't ever remember voting on that. Now, if that's the case, you know, that would be the poison pill that, you know, that would cause the director of the JEA, the CEO, to resign if he's the one that signed that, and if that's true. And for Mayor Curry and everybody to say, oh, we better just forget this for now. Mm. I mean, I think somebody needs to dig into that and to see if that's a fact.
All right. Thanks, Christopher.
Well, so with this Plant Vogtle deal, it's a 20-year power purchase agreement to eventually buy power from this. You know, we've heard $1.2 billion, $1.7 billion as a liability for that. And I know from talking with some lobbyists who are representing some of the other power companies in the state that is a huge, huge issue when it comes to purchasing JEA. I think that contract, like you said, 300 pages or whatever it is, I don't know if anybody in city government right now has a grasp of that entirely.
That's an important point.
That would seem like many people in the public were hoping or wish that we could deal with that situation prior to any conversations about privatizing JEA.
It's Friday. It's our media roundtable. We're going to take a few more calls on this, our top story of the week. Your thoughts about the denouement, the end, the finale. After months of talking about this, about JEA, and then we'll move on. David is in Mandarin. Hi, David.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, the mayor should have used the royal we like the kings when he said, he should have said, not I will not introduce a bill for credibility. He should have said we. He has so many minions running around. Maybe the we would cover them.
Is that a little shade from you, David? Are you under a shade tree down in Mandarin?
I just live in Jacksonville. It rains, you know, at a maybe a square lot at a time. I always carry an umbrella for a little shade. But one thing I would really like to mention. This is the first time I've been in Jacksonville since the 90s, and not much changed except for now. Maybe enough people are interested and have been upset enough that we might even look at the laws, the ordinances, the statutes, the rules of order, and have them followed, because none of this would have been controversial if the mayor had obeyed them. And
all right.
He doesn't, and the politicians in town don't seem to think we have to obey them. Now,
David, I got you. I hear you. And let me, I need to just take that point you're making. Going beyond the current mayoral administration, there's been a long running perception in this city that big deals get done behind the scenes with little public input, and that a small, influential donor class is really pulling the strings. And I think that's what he's getting at. Your thoughts?
I think there's a belief that that happens everywhere.
Yeah.
I think that that's probably true.
We just know who they are.
Right, exactly. I think that in some ways, the small townness of Jacksonville isn't that things are done behind closed doors and those who are connected get better treatment. It's that we kind of know who they are and we don't have that many big deals, so it becomes noticeable when we're doing this. You go to any big city, it's going to be the exact same thing. There's just more of it, and it just becomes part of the background noise.
All right, let's move on and talk about the biggest
story. That wasn't being cynical, by the way.
Of course. And talk about the biggest stories of the week. It's 549-2937 to join the conversation now. The other huge talker from the week, a major headline that actually caught people's attention all over the world, bombshell news from Jaguars owner Shad Khan. Khan announced Thursday that he is making what seems to be about a $700 million offer, maybe more, to buy one of the most iconic sports arenas in the world, London's Wembley Stadium. Now, the Jaguars have played games for 5 years now at Wembley, and they will play their October 28th game there against the Eagles. Back in 2013, Khan also bought the Fulham Football Club. That's soccer, of course, and they play at Craven Cottage in London. Khan has reiterated his commitment to keeping the Jaguars in Jacksonville, although local fans say they're worried this could mean moving the franchise out of Duval. Khan on Thursday said buying Wembley will actually enhance the Jaguars franchise.
What it does is, you know, gives us some confidence that what we're doing over there, we've had a full-time staff in London for sponsorships, planning our games for a long time. Gives them some certainty that we're going to be able to keep that up.
Give us a call at 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts about this huge news from Shad Khan. David Cotton, this came right after their State of the Franchise report, when they also talked about plans to build out the downtown sports complex to make it more of an entertainment district. So Shad Khan is making moves right and left.
Yeah, I mean, as he kind of mentioned in the media in the last couple of days, you know, I'm a global businessman with assets all over the world, and this should not worry folks in Jacksonville. This is just another investment. Well, the reality is there's perception, you know, that Jacksonville is this small market, and nationally that we haven't been able to, you know, fill a stadium or whatever thing, you know, there is out there this week. But, you know, so, Shad Khan is spending money outside of Jacksonville and then is probably going to turn around and ask city council for tens of millions of dollars to do a huge development here. So, you know.
So you think about the initial reaction from the public here locally is shock and, you know, the panic, right? Okay. But then when you step back and think about it a little bit, Jacksonville has a direct connection to London, England, right? So, and Shark Con is the reason why. There's all types of opportunity and potential there. And I think that that argument was made when the game was initially played over in London, and Shark Con was trying to make the, you know, the point that, hey, this opens up a lot of opportunity for business and for Jacksonville. But this would typically have been done with if we heard that London was connected to New York, no one would be surprised. But we're surprised because London is now connected to Jacksonville.
Tessa.
The Jaguars aren't moving to London. Guys, it's not happening. I know that we like to think that the Jaguars are that important, but really, other countries don't care about the NFL.
No. There will be a team in London. There will be an NFL team in London. Yeah.
But
yes, and there will be a team in London at some point in the next 2 decades. And that.
But
time,
will they
that,
get excited about American football?
I think there will be an NFL team in London in the next 2 decades. But the 2 decades is the part to focus on in that sentence. Is it's not that. There's not enough of a fan base yet. Very possibly the NFL can build one up large enough. And maybe it is the Jaguars who move over there in, you know, 2040. Honestly, that's pointless to talk about because it's so far away. There's nothing we could do to plan for that. What I find more interesting is this. Shad Khan has talked multiple times at State of the Franchise, where this one most recently, he has a slide that he puts up that shows which teams have new stadiums and which teams have more than 300 million upgrades, et cetera, et cetera. And this year it's down to it's the Jaguars.
And one Buffalo, other team.
So Jaguars and Buffalo are the only ones on that list. Buffalo does something. It's the Jaguars are the only ones on that list. And then he starts pumping for more money from the city. Again, not being cynical, but one might say if he just kind of goes, I got the stadium that's sitting in London. You know, if you don't want to fix up your stadium, maybe I got to move the team. Would he do that sort of hardball to get more money out of the city? Would he even need to do that sort of hardball? I don't know. But having options doesn't hurt him.
Thus far, he's gotten everything he's wanted out of the city.
Well, I think for me, the intrigue for him, and I'm not in Shark Khan's head, but it seems to me the intrigue for him is opportunity here.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like there's potential here that you can have your own situation. You've built your own situation, sort of built something out of nothing, so to speak. And to play in the same league as, an international league, bring Jacksonville to an international stage. So there's real opportunity here. It's real easy to make the connection where, we've always been paranoid about the team leaving town. And it's very difficult to kind of exit that way of thinking, especially when your team is still in a small market situation and had been losing for such a long period of time.
It is interesting to listen to Khan, though. He almost seems to have a certain frustration when it comes up. And I think it was a statement actually from Lamping during a press conference yesterday of, when the Weavers owned it, there was constant actual real chatter about them moving somewhere. Khan keeps on investing money here. Khan says he wants to stay here. Why do you keep on asking us this?
And to Charles's point, I think he makes an important point in that Jacksonville is a place where if you have a really big, bold idea and if you have money especially, you can make a pretty big impact in a pretty short amount of time. This isn't London or New York. You aren't a small fish trying to make some way for yourself. You can become a big fish and do something big. And it's a small enough city that I bet Shad Khan does like that aspect of this.
I think he loves it. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a Florida city with a blank canvas. Yeah. I mean, a major Florida city. I mean, yes, okay, it's top 50 market, but it's still an opportunity for him to sort of create Con World, Disneyland effect over here where you stay for the weekend, you eat, you stay at a hotel, you go to a game, go to a concert, this whole nine yards. But I think to Tessa's point, they're not moving. I think Shad Khan, when he bought this team, could have began taking those steps by not investing in the city-owned stadium with a partnership with the city. He could have let it tank. He didn't have to bring Mark Lamping over. He didn't have to bring Tom Coughlin over. He could have washed his hands pretty quickly.
Let's go to some calls. What are your thoughts about Shad Khan's bombshell announcement that he's buying Wembley Stadium? He's made the offer to, anyway. 549-2937. Give us a call. Rod in McClenny this morning. Hey, Rod. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. How you doing, Miss Melissa?
Doing great, thanks.
Yes, your pilot just said it. That would be my question. Do you all think that he just bought the stadium just to, in a sense, hijack Jacksonville? So if we don't give him what he wants over here, then he'll move to London? That would be my question. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that.
That's very cynical. I don't. That's obviously not the only reason he bought it. It gives him a little more leverage. But Melissa, as you said, he has gotten everything he's wanted anyhow. The flip side of that's going to be interesting. Of when the time comes for the ask for public money to do more with the stadium, some might gesture across the pond and go, "You drop somewhere between $700 million and $1.4 billion to buy a stadium." And now you're asking for city money to do something with the stadium here, huh? That's interesting. Might be one response.
Yeah, and then also the bid is just a bid. I mean, so yeah. He hasn't purchased a stadium over there yet. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done over there. And I was listening to some of the reports over in London. Wembley Stadium is very, and it's a very active venue. And so, squeezing any more gains in from NFL teams and so forth would be a challenge as it sits right now. But it's a lot of things that would have to come together and a lot of work that still needs to be done. And I think that since we have so many projects on the table here that are the focus of helping Jacksonville, that says something. That says that there's a commitment there. So it'd be very difficult for me to see how do you kind of move away from all of those projects because you're starting another project someplace else. There has to be a game plan where everything is supposed to play together.
It's funny to look at the international coverage of this, by the way. If you go to the BBC, the headline says, Fulham's billionaire owner, Shad Khan.
And then,
by the way, he also owns the NFL side Jacksonville Jaguars.
Well, and I think what we have to remember, too, this is not like the Rams moving to Los Angeles.
Exactly.
There is a collective bargaining agreement with the players' union that right now, that's not going to fly. I mean, I know they're going to go into negotiations in the next couple of years, but the league is going to have to make a lot of concessions to the players if they want to move towards moving a franchise overseas.
I'd like to find out at least poll the owners. I think some of these other owners are like, they probably feel in some kind of way right now because Shad Khan got to this deal before they did. I mean, he's the first owner to make this type of aggressive leap towards expanding in international markets like that. And I think that they've sort of teeter-tottered around it for a while, thinking that, maybe someday. But he's actually done something.
And how about he's the first minority owner of an NFL team? Is he the first owner of an NFL team to be born in another country? Yeah. I don't know, but I think he is. He has brought international flair to this most American of traditions, the NFL.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable.
It is. And what I find interesting, to probe that a little bit is what you just said about the idea of him moving quickly on this when the other owners have not. And it is one of the good things about the Lot J project is he has shown that when he does do something, he's going to move ahead with it. I mean, Dahlia's Place, if Dahlia's Place had been done in the traditional fashion that things are done in Jacksonville, it would have taken about 3 years, and it would have been this thing that dragged on. There would have been a thing, and we would have found contamination, and
over
the financing fell through, and we need more city money. And it was like 9 months from groundbreaking to opening. It was done. 200,000 people attend concerts there, and since it's opened, that is the type of thing that Jacksonville doesn't actually see all the time. And I think it will actually calm for those who have fears about the team moving, if the Lot J project goes on that type of speedy path, I think that will end up quelling a lot of those fears.
All right. And lots of talk about that story, of course, and there will continue to be. But we're going to move on and make note of another important story from the week here on our Friday Media Roundtable. If you're just tuning in, the number to join us is 549-2937. And also this week, plenty of news and drama coming out of the Duval County School Board. First, the board has announced it's narrowed down a list of 6 candidates to become the district's next superintendent. The district has been without a permanent leader since Nicolai Vitti left about a year ago to head up Detroit schools. Patricia Willis has been acting as the interim superintendent in the meantime. So that's news point number one. Number two, the board announced it has to cut more than $60 million from its already tight budget due to mandated state cuts. This as teachers are walking out in states across the country demanding better pay. Often teachers have to take second jobs just to make ends meet. So the budget cuts are going to certainly be felt in our public schools. And third, board member Scott Shine withdrew his candidacy for re-election this week, and he actually walked out of a board meeting early, saying he felt attacked after clashing with his colleagues. They had criticized him for going to the media with his concerns about the superintendent search rather than discussing it first privately with his fellow board members. So a lot of education news to discuss. We want your calls at 549-2937. Tessa Duval, there's a lot to get into over at
where do you even start? This thought that a board should have a unified voice, that one member shouldn't have the authority to speak to the media, that's not how this works. If you are elected to a position, you have the obligation to be accountable for that. That doesn't mean that you all seven have to be in agreement, but this thought that you need to be unified to do your job, that's just not how this works. That's not how city council works. That's not how school board works. But I've got to tell you, I was also surprised to see Mr. Shine's statements that, you know, when Dr. Vitti left the school board, he sort of lost interest in serving, because the board is the boss of the superintendent. The board does not serve the superintendent. The superintendent works at the pleasure of the board. And if you're on school board, you're there to serve children. You're not there to serve one man and his vision. You're there to serve the tens of thousands of children in this community.
Yeah, I mean, he said in a statement that, this experience was strange and foreign to him. So that's certainly an interesting mark there. He's saying that there were personal attacks lobbied at him when he walked out of this last meeting.
Not in politics, no.
You know, it's like, wow, you know. I think it's a shock to anybody who covers this. I think there also should be a little bit more eyes covering this as well, because this is coming as a surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah, and our own Lindsay Kilbride covers the school board quite admirably. She couldn't be on the show today, but I would point everyone to her stories. Tim Gibbons.
I was just surprised after the Kids Hope Alliance and the JEA situation. I had assumed that you had to have a board member resign to become superintendent. So
that's the secret plan.
Right, this process is strange and foreign. It's like they're doing a search committee and stuff.
You're right about that. The school board they were very careful and took a lot of time and effort into involving, or at least trying to involve, the public in the superintendent search. There were several meetings held, and ask what you want to see. There were, who would you like to see? Would you like to see this new superintendent? Would you like to see a new superintendent? And they got, they got six candidates now. So, none of them really kind of stand out any more than the other. They still have more information, more vetting to do on them, I believe. And then they're going to have to vote and pick someone.
Well, and China said, maybe we need to hold off until the 2018 election cycle.
Yeah, he also had some recommendations for a superintendent that he liked to stick in there himself.
He didn't like the idea of the board choosing the superintendent, the current makeup of the board.
Yeah. Because we're so close to elections in November, but that's the way it rolls. I mean, that's how it rolls. You serve until the end of your term, and you have to fulfill the duties of your
isn't Supreme Court picks. It's not like we can keep a thing open and. Mm-hmm.
At the semifinal, are you making a Merrick Garland reference? Okay. Neil Gorsuch reference? Okay. The half dozen semifinalists for the new superintendent of Duval Schools are the chief in Nashville, the superintendent in Houston, the superintendent in Manatee County, Florida, the chief of schools in Hillsborough County, that's Tampa, the superintendent in Wayne County, Florida, and a superintendent in Illinois. So those are the six, and they will narrow it down from there. Yeah. And you got to wonder, as they read the headlines coming out of Jacksonville, if that might creep some of them off of this position. I don't know.
I haven't covered school board, actually not enough for years, but having covered enough political entities where I think people who get these type of jobs are kind of aware of, there's a lot of at least vaguely dysfunctional school boards, city councils, et cetera, out there. And I guess that's just part of the job. I do think it is a testimony to Jacksonville that we have this strong of a slate of candidates. I mean, there are some really good names on here. And I think that says something that people would want to come here to have that job.
There are. But that said, let me ask all of you your thoughts about the fact that the school district is cutting $62 million out of the budget. it's already a very tight budget, and school funding is extremely controversial in Florida as districts are suing the state legislature over the increased allocation of funding going to charter schools. We see this spectacle in multiple states now of teachers striking and walking out and tens of thousands of teachers marching in cities around the country saying, enough is enough. We are not being paid anywhere near what we can even live on. Teachers are dipping into their own pocketbooks to bring in basic school supplies for their students. The teaching profession, I think it's fair to say, is at a real crisis point right now in America.
Absolutely. And I hate that that is the second story, you know, that, you know, cuts to school funding is sort of below this, you know, political dance at the school board level. You know, there was a lot made during this legislative session at the end of it about, well, maybe we should, you know, pay for, you know, arming teachers or putting more, you know, school resource officers. But teachers are over here have been saying for years, we don't have enough money to do our jobs as it is. We don't get paid enough. So how do we have money for that?
And I think that was one of the things in the public discussion about what do you want to see in the next superintendent is, you know, strong teacher advocates. And hopefully one of these candidates will, kind of stand out as a strong advocate for teachers and how to support them in the classroom, because that is definitely needed. And the $62 million situation, if you like to call it, is going to be, I think, is if I were one of these candidates, I would, that might have a impact on whether I wanted to continue to move forward in this process.
Yeah, I could see that killing someone's interest way more than board infighting. You know, as Tessa said, the board people are supposed to speak out. That type of thing is more par for the course. But you can see someone looking at this job going, not with those type of financial constraints. I don't know, and somebody else on the panel might, but my understanding is that Florida teachers can't strike in the way they have
in the traditional
states.
Way. I was just going to point that out, Tim. Now, of course, in recent days, we've seen teachers from West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona walk off the job calling for better pay and conditions. Teachers in Colorado are about to do the same. The last time this happened in Florida was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
In 1968, teachers across the state walked off the job. They got what they wanted, more money for schools and a change to the education funding formula in this state. But there was a backlash to that massive statewide teacher strike in Florida 50 years ago. The law is such, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they are not as free to do that as they were before.
My understanding is they've been basically classified as public servants. And I grew up in an area that teacher strikes, it was old coal mining country, you know, heavy union presence. Teacher strikes were just like a fact of life. And so I looked into it a little bit, and I believe that the way they're classified in Florida, they can't strike, at least not in a traditional sense.
Yeah. And a lot of the problems, a lot of the barriers to supporting schools, providing better support to schools is in the funding formula. And, you know, and the legislature has to deal with that. They were very quick to find support for, school protection measures. But you mentioned earlier that this is difficult for them to require. I mean, how do you, manage that? You're going to give them more money to protect the students, but you're not really concerned about what the learning part of the course of the day.
I just think teachers are going to have a hard time convincing Richard Corcoran that this issue needs to come back for a special session. I mean, he tweeted out something yesterday from, praising the education secretary, and who is, kind of a controversial figure in the Trump administration right now. So, while they're debating whether or not they should have a special session about gambling, education's probably not on their list of priorities, unfortunately.
All this as districts are actually suing the state legislature over this. And as you were all talking, I looked this up. Teachers unions in Florida are advising teachers not to stage walkouts. It's against the law in this state. The state constitution specifies that public employee organizations are prohibited from participating in a strike or instigating a strike or even supporting a strike. Some Florida teachers are taking to social media to organize a unified action on pay and essentially going around the union leadership, at least on social media.
Yeah. A budget is a reflection of priorities. And so when we see that our school district locally has to cut more than $60 million, I mean, what message does that send about the priorities of our society? You know, some of the things that the district is having to look at doing or is proposing to do, instead of, you know, schools having their own PE teacher and their own art teacher, which is already an area where there aren't enough art teachers, they're going to have to share between campuses now. Not every grade is getting new science textbooks. I mean, there are just like...
Another thing they're doing in middle schools next year, instead of the block scheduling, the A day and the B day, they're going to seven shorter classes every day.
Yeah.
Which I think is also a budget-driven decision.
Yeah. And so while we're talking about numbers, I mean, children and their futures are being affected. So yes, this is a story about numbers, but it's also a story about children who depend on the adults in their lives to make these decisions and make them as best as possible.
Yeah, advocacy for support, additional support, is going to have to come from other areas outside of the education community. If it doesn't happen, because we're used to teachers, you know, standing up for themselves and speaking out and saying, you know, I had to go buy books for my class. We're used to hearing that. But if it's not coming from the business community, if it's not coming from, you know, churches and other civic organizations, it won't get any traction.
Well, what about the Quality Education for All initiative in this city seeking more school funding? There's also the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. What about those organizations?
That's a really good point, actually, because there is a strong business community support of improving the education system historically, but in some ways since VDS left, the vocalness of that has faded. I'm not saying that their motivations or their drive have changed, but VD had a lot of support from that sector of the community that is more in the background now.
All right. And it has been such a busy news week. My goodness. and the hour is almost over, but before we go to break, we finally want to take a look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And what a fish story. Only in Florida does a fisherman reel in the granddaddy of all catfish. Yes, fisherman Joel Singletary caught a 121-pounder on April 11th in the Choctawhatchee River. It flows into the Sunshine State from Alabama. The white-bellied fish, which weighs more than 1.7 times the current record for a catfish caught in Florida, put up quite a fight as Singletary reeled it in, according to officials with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
Wow.
Did you see the picture of this fish?
It was massive.
Fish had eaten another fish.
Thought it was photoshopped.
No, I know, right? Okay, and then also, finally, only in Florida do streakers cause hilarity when they run naked across the field at a minor league baseball game. Yes, the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp survived a thriller against Pensacola Thursday night, beating them 10-9, but there was an unexpected break in the action at the bottom of the third when a guy took off his clothes and jumped right onto the field. Players from both teams stopped play to watch, and he made his way to center field where he started to climb the fence but could not make it over. He was caught quickly by security. Wait a minute. Somehow it's suddenly 1974.
Hashtag Duval things.
I'm in my parents' rec room with the simulated wood grain. My brother's upstairs playing Pong. What's going on here?
I don't think he's stripped naked. I think that's called pee on eat.
It's a nice tackle at the net.
Like a fish out of water.
Did you see the video? It's really quite horrifying. Thanks to Tessa Duvall, David Cotton, Charles Griggs, and Tim Gibbons. Keep your clothes on, guys.
Shrimping ain't easy.
The Civic Orchestra of Jacksonville's up next with a live performance. Keep listening.
New Horizons, offering IT programs designed to start your career in 3 months. Federal funding may be available. More information at newhorizons-jax.com or 564-9500.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. It's the number one killer of teens. One text or call can wreck it all. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving. More from board-certified civil trial lawyer Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
This week, Congress hosted a French president fluent in English, calling on an American president who was fluent in French.
The only thing we have to fear, it is fear itself.
Also, North Korea's leader makes history with his first visit south, and unrest in Nicaragua leaves dozens dead. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
My hero, zero. On the next Fresh Air, we remember jazz musician Bob Duro, best known for his schoolhouse rock songs like My Hero Zero and Three is a Magic Number, and for recording his song Blue Christmas with Miles Davis and co-writing I'm Hip. He died Monday. We'll listen back to his 1982 Fresh Air interview and performance. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
From doo-wop and oldies to acoustic music, listen to After Hours Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, you don't want to miss the Civic Orchestra of Jacksonville this Sunday as they play the Ritz Theater in a special performance. The group was awarded a PNC Arts Alive grant last year, and with that funding, they are producing a free concert for the community, and it celebrates and explores the cultural diversity of the city through the lens of classical music. This is their season finale, and did I mention this is a free concert? Here with a preview, spokeswoman Molly Sweet. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And in a moment, we'll hear from concertmaster Charmaine Coombs as she performs for us. Molly, this is so exciting. Dozens of local musicians have come together to form the Civic Orchestra of Jacksonville, and it sounds as though the season finale is going to be a tour de force, including some diverse selections like the classic Lift Every Voice and Sing by Jacksonville's own icon James Weldon Johnson. Right?
That's correct. So the Civic Orchestra is comprised of about 60 local musicians, all sorts of different people from all across the First Coast who have come together because they all want to play and perform in an orchestra.
Right.
So we have professional musicians, music educators, music students, and some of our musicians are actually working in other fields, but they just love performing and they want to participate. So we volunteer our time to rehearse and perform these concerts at no cost to our audiences.
Right. An opportunity to see this for free, just beautiful classical music. Now, you were lucky enough to be awarded the PNC Arts Alive grant last year. And so that is leading you up to your season two finale. What's on the agenda for this concert?
So with the funding for this concert, we got the grant and we were able to do two components to the concert. So we have identified a great program of pieces that really celebrate the cultural diversity of both Jacksonville and our country. And also there's a component of educational outreach, which leading up to the concert, our concertmaster Charmaine with us today and our artist in residence, Melinda Gopp, have been going out to local schools, elementary schools, and working with the students to introduce them to the music, do classwork with them and art pieces. And actually at the concert before the performance, Melinda is going to have her artwork on display from about 4:30 to 5.
Fabulous. And when you perform Lift Every Voice and Sing by James Weldon Johnson, the Ritz Voices will perform with the orchestra, right?
That's correct. We're very excited to have them with us and their conductor, Mrs. McDuffie. So it was great to have them. We did a dress rehearsal last Sunday and it was fantastic. Such a powerful combination with a community choir and the community orchestra.
And for people, too, that have never been to the Ritz Theater, I can't say enough good things about it. If you've never had the chance to come see a performance there, it's a fabulous theater, really rich history, and this only adds to that tradition.
Absolutely. We're very excited to be in a wonderful theater, and they're going to provide so much support to us. And through that grant, we are really able to produce a huge performance and something that's sets it apart from our previous performances in that hall.
All right. And so we've got a snippet of a piece that will be played this weekend at the concert by your concertmaster, Charmaine Coombs. What are we going to be hearing, Molly?
So we're going to be hearing a piece by Chinese composers Zhang Lu and Ma Hongya called Good News from Beijing Reaches the Borderland. This is actually a piece that was written for a traditional Chinese orchestra, so the instruments are very different from the Western classical instruments. Instead of a traditional violin, this would be played on the arhu. Very similar. It's a Chinese fiddle. Yeah, okay. So it's got two strings. It's got a different sound. And the violin section of the Civic Orchestra has had the challenge to make their instruments sound like the arhu. So Charmaine is going to demonstrate a few excerpts from that piece and how she's been able to lead the section in our interpretation of this piece.
All right, let's listen. And that's just a preview, a very short one, of the talent and artistry that will be on the stage at the Ritz Theater this Sunday at 5 o'clock. Can, you know, people in this town love to just walk up. Can they do that or do they need to reserve a ticket?
They do not. They can walk up. Again, 4:30, we'll have an artist reception for Melinda Gopp, our artist in residence. The concert starts at 5. It's about an hour-long program. And then there will be snacks and concessions available at the end of the concert and an opportunity to mingle with the musicians.
It's the Civic Orchestra of Jacksonville, their season 2 finale, this Sunday, 5 o'clock at the downtown Ritz Theater. Molly Sweet, Charmaine Coombs, kudos to you on another great season. Have a great show and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And I hope you're okay making your way out of our building as Welcome to Rockville has erected a whole city around WJCT. That's happening this weekend, too. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed anything this morning, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. And be sure to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our look at the biggest stories around the state, the Florida Roundup. 1A is up next. And if you are listening to the rebroadcast, stay tuned for music. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Whatever you're up to this weekend, enjoy it.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.